Welcome to Eastern Standard, produced for WEKU by Dynamics Productions. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for joining us. Legislation has real-life consequences. In the recent Kentucky legislative session, new guidelines for teaching history and social studies in the state's K-12 public schools became law with the passage of Senate Bill 1. And while most of that bill is aimed at reducing the power of school-based councils, education contributor Cynthia Reeser is focusing on the impact on education of particular parts of the bill that are related to teaching history and social studies.
With me today is Russell County Public School teacher Donnie Wilkerson, and he teaches fifth grade social studies, and he's won multiple awards for his teaching. Mr. Wilkerson, first, summarize the key parts of these new requirements for teachers in kindergarten through 12th grade.
Yes, Dr. Resor, thank you. Senate Bill 1, as Dr. Resor said, is the Kentucky General Assembly's response to the nationwide furor, I guess would be a good word, over this thing that's often referred to as critical race theory, something that's not really being taught in any of the public schools of Kentucky or anywhere else for that matter, but a lot of discussion about that. The bill was originally Senate Bill 138, and those provisions of that bill were put into Senate Bill 1. It's often how the legislature rolls things together at the last minute to get them passed. And basically what the bill does is it sets up a list of 24 documents that are required to be taught in sixth grade through high school. They even refer to it as the Teaching American Principles Act. That's not the part that troubles me, but the other parts of it are designed to limit, if you will, what topics can be discussed and how.
So a lot of people might not really see a problem with this, and I know you're going to share the specific parts that could very quickly become problematic.
This is a watered-down version. The original Senate Bill 138 carried much more intrusive language into the classroom, and even Senate Bill 138 was watered down from other versions of the bills that were going through the House. Here's what troubles me, is one word in this phrase. This is directly from the bill. It says, a public school shall provide instruction and instructional materials that are consistent with the understanding that the institution of slavery and post-Civil War laws enforcing racial segregation and discrimination were contrary to the fundamental American promise of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness as expressed in the Declaration of Independence. But that defining racial disparities solely on the legacy of this institution is destructive to the unification of our nation.
So what's the problem?
Well, the problem is, why would you need a but there? That first comment, that first part is wonderful. It says that a public school shall provide instruction about the horrors of the Civil War and the horrors of slavery. But they had to put a but in. And that what that does to me, and I think to any person who reads this carefully, that tells you the message, that tells you the intent, if not the letter, of what they were intending.
Which is, spell it out for us.
The intent is to stifle instruction over any teaching of any theory or any fact of history that might seem to disparage our founding fathers, especially as it comes to race and as it comes to slavery. The idea is that we need to sort of whitewash, if you will, history. And we have to teach all sides. And, you know, I'm one of the strongest patriots out there, but I also like for my students to know both the bad and the good, and we have to learn from our mistakes. But I think this particular provision of the bill tends to put a dampening effect on that.
In other words, it's like saying, if we point out racial disparity, we are not patriotic. Is that?
Exactly. It's saying that by pointing out our flaws, it's like that we can't teach that Thomas Jefferson. Here's what I tell my students. I love Thomas Jefferson, but I also hate him. You can do both.
Yeah. Nobody's perfect.
Nobody's perfect.
He was a great leader, but he was also a slave owner.
That's exactly right. And for people that go to his home today, both sides are now being presented.
But this but may actually stifle teachers from being able to present that reality.
Exactly. And the one that's more troubling is the second provision that says any instruction or instructional material, and when I see the word instructional material, I read book into that, on current controversial topics related to public policy or social affairs provided to public school students shall be, and here this is going to sound good, within the range of knowledge, understanding, age, and maturity of the students receiving the instruction, and relevant, objective, non-discriminatory, and respectful, here's the clincher, to differing perspectives of students. Now, that might seem innocuous on its cover, mm-hmm. unless you dig a little deeper. Number one, range of knowledge, age, and understanding. Who is going to decide? Who's going to be the arbiter or the book police for the class to say, is it okay if I use an eighth grade level book in my class to teach about American history? Is it okay if I quote from a speech that has a 11th grade reading level or maybe a bit mature? That's going to be anybody's call. It's going to be the parents' call, public's call, whoever wants to challenge what's happening in the classroom. But this phrase, differing perspectives of students, again, sounds okay, sounds innocuous, unless you think about situations like what happened in Texas, where they have a bill similarly worded, and a curriculum coordinator down in Carroll, Texas, instructed her teachers that they would now have to have a book on their shelves and teach about the other side of the Holocaust. Now, can you imagine the other side of the Holocaust? That's one of those things I don't think there is another side. But their instructions were, because you have Holocaust deniers, and we all know that there are not a lot of them, but they're out there. We have to, under the letter of this law, we have to honor their differing perspective.
So it sounds like differing perspective could be the teacher has to authenticate something that's a lie.
That's correct. They have to give it some credibility by the fact that they would do that. I draw the analogy to 100 years ago in Dayton, Tennessee, with the theory of evolution. Now we're 100 years later saying that we may have to teach that the KKK had a good side.
Right, right.
And I hate to make light of it, but that's the kind of thing we're facing.
I can think of times as a high school teacher where I had students state things, and they just didn't know, but they stated things that were shockingly wrong. It wasn't a differing perspective. They were just wrong. So it sounds like this kind of phrase could actually make anything okay, because it falls under this respect to differing perspectives of students.
That's exactly right. And the precedent is out there from bills that have already been passed across the country. Tennessee has a similarly worded legislation, and a group of parents in Tennessee challenged the book, believe it or not, The Story of Ruby Bridges, an innocuous little picture book that's won all kinds of awards about the plight of little Ruby Bridges and her being the first African-American child to integrate a school, because one of the pages says that on Ruby's first day, a large crowd of angry white people gathered outside. And it's really just a statement of fact, but they challenged that under the guise of a bill like this in Tennessee.
So what's going to happen if a teacher in Kentucky says something or uses a curriculum material? And again, you know, today that can be books, that can be electronic materials, things from the internet. So if a teacher uses something that a parent or a student or someone in the community decides is, quote, not respectful of differing perspectives of students, what's going to happen?
Well, that's a good question. The bill itself does not have a penalty per se included in the wording. There was one inadvertently in the bill, and they scrambled at the last minute because they knew that would kill the bill, and they took that out. But since it's been pointed out that Kentucky Revised Statutes 522.030, that's the Kentucky law, it's called official misconduct in the second degree. And it says that basically, a teacher is guilty of official misconduct in the second degree if they violate any state regulation or law. So a parent could challenge this. I suppose literally bring charges against a teacher for not doing what this bill or what they think this bill says they should do. The penalty for being found guilty of official misconduct in the second degree is up to a $250 fine and 90 days in jail.
Which, of course, also, if that happens to a teacher, then that's definitely going to threaten their position as a teacher, their job.
It would certainly. Now, we have to think that, and I know certainly to respect my superintendent and principal here, they're very forward-thinking people. They're going to intervene and prevent this kind of thing. They're not going to let this happen. But in some districts, the possibility of this is very real.
So what do you think is going to be the impact on classrooms in Kentucky? People haven't been talking about this. This is a relatively new law that's still being digested. What's going to happen?
Well, here's my biggest fear with the whole thing. Because I really don't think you're going to see teachers thrown in jail. That is a bit of a stretch. I certainly hope that no one is going to do that. But here's what's going to happen, I think. I think it's going to have a very chilling effect. By that I mean administrators, superintendents, principals are going to err on the side of caution when it comes time to having those yearly meetings about curriculum and about giving teachers sort of their marching orders, if you will, for the year. I think you're going to hear things like, well, you know, it's probably okay if you talk about the Holocaust, and it's probably okay if you talk about the Middle Passage and the horrors of slavery, and you talk about some of these bad things that happened and about the blue laws and about a lot of things that we know are sort of black marks in our history. I think they're going to say, Let's just don't rock the boat, you know, tread lightly. So what's going to happen is students are going to get a very, very dumbed down version of history.
And, you know, not just history, because this mentioned current events as well. So how are we going to discuss controversial current events, you know, maybe not with younger students, but with middle and high school students that see what's going on in the world and they need to learn about that in the classroom? How are those discussions going to take place now?
I have a feeling that they're going to be very, very limited, and it does impact. It's going to impact the literature classrooms, the ELA classrooms, science, you name it. This not only impacts, and really it is a social studies history bill, but nothing in the bill limits it from applying to teachers teaching about anything.
And, you know, that's a good point. Climate change is real, but a student with a differing perspective might quote bad information, and there's a lot of it about there, that it's not. So how does a teacher address that?
We're going to have to be very creative. One of the things I'm working on is some training that would assist teachers toward that end.
You know, we've been talking in this series of interviews over the last 2 years about the shortage of teachers and how teachers are not paid what they should be and all the stresses that COVID has placed on them, all the additional work. So you're right. This is not just going to have a chilling effect on what's taught in a classroom, but gosh, who wants this additional burden as well? So it may have a really big impact on the growing teacher shortage.
Oh, absolutely. And even to the point that teachers that are currently teaching, this may be the proverbial straw that broke the camel's back.
Yeah.
The thing that I value the most is that First Amendment. And I think this bill is certainly not in accordance with that backbone of our Constitution.
So I've been talking to Donnie Wilkerson, Russell County history teacher, and thank you so much for joining us today.
Coming up after the break, a little bit of this, a little bit of that.
Move yourself and feel your way to the crowd.
Some outsized art.
I would say my most notable, recognizable aspect of my murals are repetition and color.
And the days of wine in Winchester.
Probably the best part is just how wine brings people together.
I'm Tom Martin, and you're listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.
Major support for WEKU comes from Kentucky's Touchtone Energy Cooperatives, reminding Kentuckians when it comes to electricity, safety is within your power. Be cautious around overhead or buried power lines, take care around downed power lines, and always teach children about electric safety.
WEKU is supported by Hicks and Funson. Kentucky lawyers Josh Hicks, Greg Funson, Kenny Heumann, Kayla Combs, and Mitch Whitaker provide legal representation for car and truck accidents and other personal injury matters. More information at 859-777-7000.
Now, back to Eastern Standard with Tom Martin.
In these days of disruption and change, the term renewal can mean a lot of things. It's the title and the theme of the Lexington Philharmonic 2022-23 season, for one thing. And joining us to talk about that title and the music that it represents is Lexphil Executive Director Allison Kaiser. Welcome back to Eastern Standard, Allison.
Thank you, Tom. It's such a delight to be back here with you.
And so, renewal, how did you arrive at that as a title?
Well, we went through a lot of different possibilities, but we felt like renewal expressed the joy and the optimism and the way that we're going to be approaching the 22-23 season, in that this year, you know, this year that we're currently in has been bumpy for getting people to feel comfortable to come back to the concert hall. But we feel like the music itself is going to be renewing for our listeners. And the idea of renewal just embodies so many different positive thoughts and emotions that it tracked with what we were looking at for the 22-23 season.
And in this season, we're going to hear some music that's actually new to Lexphil, right?
Quite a bit, actually. Uh-huh. We're doing quite a bit of new music. I would say every program that we're doing has at least two pieces that are new to the orchestra on it.
Will there be some new venues?
Yes. They're new in the sense of if you look back against the 1920 season, but they're actually venues that we've been testing new collaborations that we've embarked on during these last couple of years. So we will be continuing our collaboration with the Lyric Theater and with Josephine Sculpture Park. And our new location partner is the African Cemetery No. 2.
And connected to that will be a continuation of the music of Lexington native Julia Perry.
That's correct.
And the historian Yvonne Giles, is she involved?
Oh, yes. She is one of our key collaborators, and we wouldn't be able to explore the life and work of Julia Perry to the depth that we've been able to without Yvonne. She has just been amazing in helping us to find information about the Perry family. And when we embarked upon this, it was Yvonne's enthusiastic engagement that really helped to fuel our desire to make sure that the work of Julia Perry is brought back up to the surface for not just the Lexington Philharmonic, but for orchestras all over the country.
Yes, Yvonne Giles is a true Lexington treasure.
She really is.
Sandbox percussion. That looks and sounds interesting. I did some YouTubing as I was preparing for this and came across them. It's really, really fascinating music. They'll be performing Viet Quang's Renewal. Tell us what we're listening to here.
They are going to open with a non-traditional instrument, I guess you'd call it that, but something most adults are familiar with, which are wine glasses. And the wine glasses have different levels of fluid in them that give them each a different tone. And part of their emphasis in the music that they perform is they want to show us how we can take things we don't think of as percussion instruments and make absolutely beautiful music. And their focus on things that are renewable, things that are recycled, things that are part of our everyday lives that we don't think of as musical or rhythmic or percussive instruments can be incorporated to make really amazing sounds and just beautiful music. To me, it's so fascinating to watch musicians who are all, you know, trained to be classical musicians, to use the instruments that they know and to use new things that they don't know in ways that we would never imagine.
Also, violinist Simone Porter will be performing Barber's Violin Concerto, and here she is with the Seattle Symphony. C. Simone Porter performing Barber's Violin Concerto with the Seattle Symphony. She'll be doing that with Lexville when she comes to Lexington. Allison must feel mighty good to be launching a new season, and I know that you also have some educational programs that are launching.
Oh, right? Yes, and launching the new season is tremendously exciting for us. And then you mentioned our educational program on the theme of new. We have a new learning and partnership program manager with the Lexington Philharmonic who joined us this past December. His name is Alex Chadwell, and he's been putting together a very rigorous program for educational work within our school system, working with the schools, primarily elementary schools, to put together a program that is sequential and thorough and lasts for a much longer period of time than the kind of educational programs that we've done in the past. So we're calling these residencies, and we're looking to work with 3 to 5 schools in our first year, which will be next year, with these residencies. And each of the residencies will last either half of a school year or an entire school year. And the work will be with 1 or 2 classes at each school, and there'll be an hour to 2 hours with each class every week so that we can work with the teachers and the educators to integrate music into not only their day or the week of each student, but helping the teachers to understand how to integrate music into other parts of the curriculum to help introduce and help students find an entryway, particularly into other STEM subjects like technology and engineering and physics even, and math, of course, math and music and counting, yeah.
Allison Kaiser, Executive Director of Lexville. Thank you so much, Allison, and good luck.
Thank you, Tom, and thanks for having us back on Eastern Standard. We really appreciate it.
Well, glad to have you. We'd like to welcome Kate Savage to Eastern Standard. Kate is the founder of the Lexington nonprofit Arts Connect and has a finger on the pulse of the creativity happening all around our region. In this first episode of her series, Kate talks with Lexington muralist Wiley Caudill.
Originally from Cynthiana, Kentucky, and a self-confessed rebel, Wiley Caudill, who comes from a long line of artists, musicians, actors, and quiltmakers, tried to repress his artistic instincts and resisted following in his family footsteps. But sometimes when we try to run from our destiny, we find that when we supposedly arrive, it's where we were all along. Just so for Wiley, who soon discovered that after studying broadcasting and electric media at Eastern Kentucky University, he really wasn't passionate about that career field, and art kept coming back around and giving him a nudge. So after he finally started paying attention to his instincts, his calling as a muralist revealed itself, and his career quite literally took off. So we'd like to talk about when he first noticed his stars were aligned and where he's headed now. Thank you for being with us today, Wiley.
Thank you for having me.
So what and when was that sort of aha moment of revelation when you knew you wanted to be an artist?
I think it was, I was sitting in Chocolate Holler, which is a coffee shop in Lexington, and I had just done a couple of murals for the company I was working for, which was Kentucky for Kentucky. It's a t-shirt company and Kentucky branded place. And I realized, you know, I think this is something I can do full time. I've kind of had a few jobs on a smaller scale, sporadically. And then I was like, you know what? I think being an artist is for me. I think I can do this and support myself without having any other job.
So how did it feel when you made that decision to go full time as a mural artist?
It was really exciting in that moment because I was overwhelmed with the confidence of being able to do that and so like relieved to have like picked a career that I felt like was suited for me. But at the same time, it was scary because it was completely dependent on myself and my own work ethic and my own motivation and ability to acquire jobs and manage all of that.
So when you work with a client, Do you find they look to you for the ideas, or do you find it better to try and coax ideas from them first?
I think it's best to coax ideas from the client first, just to have something to jump off of. I've found that when somebody doesn't know what they want at all, and I give them a design that is completely Wiley Coddle, they always, you know, they like it, but they then start to have ideas about how the art can tell the story of their brand and relate to them. So I think it's the step when we start with ideas from the clients, and it's an easier way to find inspiration. It's really difficult, I find, to design, you know, when you have nothing, to start at a blank canvas. But when there's some sort of like limit or some sort of, you know, seed to grow a stem from in a flower and get to a final point, definitely getting an idea from the client, I think, is easiest.
So what, in fact, inspires you? Where do you get your ideas from then?
I love to get inspiration from movies, and I love inspiration from music and different audio bites. I think I can visualize things from an audible standpoint often. I do that a lot more often when I don't work with a client and I'm just like painting for myself or just, you know, making a canvas piece or something. But a lot of times inspiration just does come from the client. If they have a neat idea, I know how to grow that idea and make it flourish. But I also get inspiration from social media. A lot of times when I'm thinking about a mural, I think in terms of how it will photograph and, you know, will people want to interact with it? And I'll edit things and manipulate things so that it makes people want to interact with the artwork.
In some cases, I've seen your murals develop into an entire brand for a business. And here I'm thinking about the Horse on High Knoll, that wealth management group on Short Street. So tell us how that kind of came about and they embraced it as their brand going forward.
Yeah, they didn't know exactly what they wanted on the side of their building because they were also, in addition to Heinel Wealth Advisory, they were opening an Airbnb on the top floor. So they wanted something fun that would attract a bit of tourism and make their Airbnb and their business more interesting. So they had thought of something, maybe something local like a horse. I kind of ran with the idea of a horse, but if we're going to do a horse, it's going to be, you know, really fun and interesting and not a typical thoroughbred that you see so often in Lexington. So they originally wanted like a very small mural, like a 10 by 10 foot mural. And I asked them if we could do the whole wall. So I did the whole wall. And that sort of became a big part of their branding because it's so notable on the side of their building. It's more notable than, you know, the sign, you know, that's advertising them. So a lot of their social media incorporates that horse. And it's a way to tell people, you know, where the building is. You can't miss it. It's the big pink horse. So yeah, I guess that's kind of like just that huge visual really launched their branding. And that's how you know where Heinel Wealth is.
Well, it's certainly a landmark on Short Street. So
thank you.
Would you say that you have a signature style, something that you always incorporate into your work that makes it immediately recognizable as a Wiley Coddle?
I would say my most notable recognizable aspect of my murals are repetition and color. I love finding one small thing and repeating it 1,000 times. I think that's so interesting and overwhelming to look at. And I find that it always photographs really well as along with looking really cool in person because sometimes artwork is one or the other. For instance, I painted a room head to toe in these blue roses. And alone, one blue rose is pretty, it's interesting, but when you overwhelm the space in this one thing, it really elevates it and just overwhelms you in color and fantasy and inspiration. So definitely repetition, and I love big, bold colors as well.
Tell the story, Wiley, of how you ended up painting one of your apartments based off some inspiration from The Devil Loves Prada, or Wears Prada, yeah. Excuse me.
Yeah, there is this really amazing monologue in that movie that Meryl Streep says, and it's about the color cerulean and how that Anne Hathaway's sweater in that scene is the color cerulean, and that sweater was not just, you know, it was chosen for her. It's very specific about this color, and I think it's such a funny and interesting and cool monologue that it made me really consider that color cerulean. And so I wanted to do a mural inspired by that, and I wanted it to, like, again, I was inspired by the movie, but also social media. Like, if I use that monologue as the background music for the process video I'm going to make of this mural, I think that would be really interesting because you can see not only the finished piece, but the inspiration that started it all in one video. So I had this idea of taking the color cerulean, but making them into roses so you can see all these different shades of cerulean in one mural. And I repeated these roses on one wall in my apartment. And I got this neon sign that said cerulean, and that's how that mural came to be. And it got so popular on TikTok that I recreated it in my new studio, which I was just talking about, with the roses from the ceiling to all the walls and the floor.
And the floor. Incredible. So you've mentioned several times social media, and I know it's played a huge part for you. How do you see it as having played a role in where you are today? And also, how do you consider it to be part of every artist's need in terms of making a presence for themselves?
I would say social media is kind of at the forefront of anything I create. I really embrace new social media, new technology, and I think that my clients do as well. People really want these murals and pieces of art that can not only be beautiful within their location in person, but also they want it to attract people from the internet and social media. So when I am designing a mural, I always think in terms of photography and how it will look in a video or a photograph and how it can be posted later online. So it's one of the most important aspects in my art form. I just want everything to look good online as well as in person, because that's how we operate nowadays, is we see something online and then we go find it in real life. It's never really the other way around. And it's also just the easiest way to get people to see your artwork. If you make something that's really cool and it looks cool online as well, then not only will people see it on the internet, but then they will see it in person too. So it's social media is a huge consideration for me when I create artwork.
How do you manage to balance your painting with the business side of your work?
It's difficult, and it's definitely something I'm learning and getting better and better at every day, I think. But what is most difficult, I think, is I spend, you know, sometimes 6 hours to maybe even like 12 or 13 hours a day painting. And while I'm painting, I don't make time to like check the emails or the texts and look at future inquiries. So scheduling time to have these days where I look at these emails and everything is difficult, because, you know, some murals take longer, some take shorter. And I always fill my time with painting and forget about the business side of things. But you have to make time for that in order to, you know, schedule your next job. I think the best decision I've ever made was asking my mom to be my scheduling manager, which has been amazing, because she checks my email throughout the day because I don't. And she replies to things, and she'll call me with updates about inquiries and things like that to keep things moving. But yeah, the business side of being a mural artist is something I am still working on getting good at.
So talking about the business side and keeping up with the inquiries, what are you actually working on now and what's coming up next?
My current project is a mural at the Lexington Public Library at their downtown location. They have just built a STEAM lab, which is an acronym for science, technology, engineering, arts, and math. And this mural has many symbols of the acronym of STEAM. And I'm placing it inside of these little honeycomb hexagon-shaped patterns that repeat all through the mural. It's very kid-friendly, lots of bright colors, but it's also like this really interesting repeating honeycomb pattern that looks like, you know, like technology. So that's my current project. And then coming up, I have a second horse that I am painting for Lexington's Horse Mania, which Lex Arts puts on. I just painted one life-size horse covered in blue roses, cerulean roses. And the second one that I should be getting soon will be covered in these golden tobacco leaves.
Well, it sounds as if you're busy indeed. Good luck with all those projects.
Thank you.
That's Wiley Coddle, a mural artist with his practice here in Lexington. Thank you for joining us, Wiley.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
From Arts Connect for Eastern Standard, I'm Kate Savage.
Now and then, Lexington produces a killer band, the kind that you hear and you just know that there's some serious potential up on that stage. Magnolia Boulevard has that very special something, and lead singer Maggie Noel paid us a visit. Maggie Noel, welcome to Eastern Standard.
Thank you so much for having me.
So your 2020 EP, New Illusion, is just absolutely awesome, I have to say. There's some seriously great music in those four songs, and to bring everybody listening onto the wavelength that we're on right now, I'd like to just begin with a sampling. Maggie, your voice is definitely its own thing, but do you get comparisons with people like Susan Tedeschi or Bonnie Raitt or maybe Carolyn Wonderland, people like that?
I do. I get the Susan Tedeschi comparison a lot, and it's just one thing I don't think I could ever be mad about in my life.
I'd say so. Well, the EP was produced by none other than Paul Reed Smith. If you're a guitar player, you've heard of PRS Guitars. He's a world-famous guitar maker. How did that happen?
Man, we've been so blessed with just the opportunity that we've came to. We actually played a show here in Lexington. It was Will Cutt's 50th year anniversary, and PRS was doing a little clinic there, as well as, you know, other guitar makers. And our buddy Brandon Bowles, always got to give him the shout out for this one, because he definitely pushed us forward and, you know, just opened a whole new world. But
he made the connection?
He did. He asked if we could play a set for their anniversary, and we were the last band to play. And I guess Paul just took a liking to us, and we made friends immediately, and I think it was like 2 or 3 weeks after that particular show, PRS was doing their Experience PRS. They only do it a couple, every other year, I think, in Maryland, and he invited us up there to play that as well.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, last September, as if the pandemic hadn't already done a number on live performance, you got some pretty terrible news that your drummer, Todd Copeland, had died. You've described Todd as the spiritual backbone of the band. did you all go through a time of uncertainty about whether to carry on?
You know, we did, especially because his death was just so out of the blue, took us by surprise. We had so many shows booked still yet, and there was a little bit of uncertainty, but there was also so many people who came forward, you know, to help fill the void, which is a very big void to fill. But I don't know. I definitely had some concerns, you know, like, because there's never going to be a drummer like Todd, especially just not only what he did for the band as far as his instrument, but, you know, like I said, his spirit, and this band was his baby. He did so much. He did a lot of the recordings and editing, and you name it, he did a lot for the band. So We definitely realized, though, like, we have to continue to push through, because you got to do it for Todd. You know, he would mm-hmm. he would definitely be disappointed if we decided to end it.
Yeah. You know, it's moments like the times like this when you realize that each individual in a band can really have an outsized impact on the band when they're mm-hmm. suddenly gone.
Mm-hmm.
That happened to us, too. The Patrick McNeese band. We lost Patrick last year.
Mm-hmm. My condolences.
It's devastating when it happens because you become so close to mm-hmm. everybody. It's like a family almost.
It is.
You released a single this year, My Old Friend. Is that a tribute to Todd?
Yeah, we actually wrote, Ryan Allen, our keys player, we collaborated on this song for a friend of ours that passed away in 2020, Daniel Whittington. Everybody called him Little Bear. We had released, I think, just a little version of that on YouTube for Little Bear. And Todd actually sang harmony on that track as well. And so it was definitely fitting, and we wanted to, you know, continue to pay our respects to Todd, and it hadn't really been released officially, so.
And then I smile, just like old times.
And this is Todd's voice that we're hearing and
mm-hmm.
doing her. Wow.
Yeah.
Well, I know it's hard to even think about replacing somebody, especially a person in talent like Todd, but you've gotten there. Tell us about Chad Gravett.
Chad is so wonderful. Like I said, we had so many people come forward to help out, but Chad's energy is great. Chad and Todd actually went to school together. They did drumline together. And it's great. It brings in a whole new flavor, you know, because Chad, he's done a lot of work. He's done a lot with like some reggae bands. So his style is slightly different, but it really works really well with us. And he's just so easy to get along with. And I love also that him and Todd were so close. You know, just the best of friends. And now I'm getting to hear all these stories.
That worked out pretty well then, I guess.
Yeah, it did.
And then you've got guitarist Greg Irwin. You got a keyboardist, Ryan Allen. As you mentioned, bassist John Roberts. I mean, it's mind-blowing. They're from around here?
They are. Well, relatively. Ryan and Greg. Ryan is from Jackson. Greg's from Hazard. John Roberts, he's I want to say from like New Haven, Kentucky area, Paducah maybe even, but he's lived in Lexington for quite a while. So we all primarily live here except for Ryan. Ryan's still back at the farm in Jackson. Mm. Lucky.
You all are just about getting ready to go back out on tour. How are you feeling about the business now, coming out of the pandemic and all that?
You know, I'm really hopeful, and I think the fact that people didn't get the live music experience for so long, I feel like it really brought that to light, and people are more appreciative because, you know, the first couple festivals and shows we've played since everything has kind of relaxed a little more. I mean, you can just tell people are ready to go, ready to listen to music, and yeah, I'm hopeful.
Well, I wanted to ask you about that groove that you set up. It is a groove, and people fall into it. And I'd like to ask you, Maggie, to talk to us about that connection with the audience. Does something happen when you can sense that people have locked into the music?
Yeah, I truly believe so. We're definitely a live music band. We perform better when the crowd's engaged, and it's part of the music for me personally, and I think, like I said, to go back to the pandemic and stuff, you can just tell people and their energy, they're so ready for this. So it makes it that much more fulfilling.
It's kind of an organic thing. I mean, it's almost like the audience becomes another instrument sometimes.
Absolutely, yeah.
That's Maggie Noel, lead singer with the Lexington-based band Magnolia Boulevard. You can find them on Spotify, on all the other online streamers, and you can check out an album on Bandcamp recorded live last summer at the Music in the Mountains concert series in Big Sky, Montana. And we'll link to that on our site, esweku.org. Thank you, Maggie.
Thank you.
I melted on the pavement that you laid out for me. And wilted, oh, wilted are the leaves that hang from me. And I ain't never tried to feel this way inside.
Molly Thompson from our partner LexToday.com is here with the latest in their contribution to Eastern Standard, exploring great day trip destinations all around the region, places like Winchester.
I'm speaking today with Nini Edwards, who is the owner of Harkness Edwards Vineyard, as well as a board member for the Tourism Board in Winchester. So we're just going to talk a little bit about Winchester today. I had the pleasure of going to Winchester this past weekend, taking the back roads, which if you are someone that loves real estate and farmland, I highly recommend just going straight out Winchester Road and taking Combs Ferry Road to get a good preview of some beautiful historical homes and some new modern farmhouses that are being built. My first stop out in Winchester was at Nini's place, Harkness Edwards Vineyard, which was so beautiful. The Peach House, which you may have heard of or have seen online, is all that it's chalked up to be. So, Nini, if you want to talk a little bit about your just kind of life growing up on a vineyard, and I'll just let you start there.
Well, thank you for the kind words. I agree. I think the Peach House is everything it's chalked up to be. It's really, really cute out here. And growing up on a vineyard, honestly, I'll be honest, I didn't realize how cool it was when I was a kid, you know, because a lot of it's farming, you know, when you have a vineyard, it's farming first. So it was a lot more farm talk than it was, you know, wine talk, but it was really fun. We have so many tourists come through here. We meet a lot of cool people. And probably the best part is just how wine brings people together. So I've met so many fun characters along the way who come and visit our location and enjoy the wine and enjoy the space. So, yeah.
It's so cool. You know, when we were there this past weekend and we were talking about how Winchester seems to be like a craft beverage destination, you know, 100%. Ale 81 is there. Obviously, there's a beautiful vineyard there. There's a great brewery, a Better Brewing, which we got to stop in for one of their fun events on Saturday night. What do you think it is about Winchester that's, you know, makes it that way, you know, that it's becoming this like craft beverage destination for people?
You know, I think it is, well, first of all, it's a cool artsy community. Kind of our tagline is always original because it is a lot of craft people out here, a lot of music, just kind of that whole, that culture of just artistic and hands-on and craft. Mm-hmm. And we're also right outside of Lexington. So like you said, I'm on the tourism board. So I think tourism all the time. Well, we get a lot of people come from Lexington to come visit us. And a lot of those people like to explore the area via drinking, you know, via, that's just a great way to kind of travel around and see the countryside. So I think it's just kind of a natural progression and, it's just fun. It's just fun.
Yeah. It's like a way to sip and see our 100%. Culture. Yeah.
Yeah.
Like you said, just outside of Lexington. That's what I love about, you know, seeing the resurgence of these smaller towns like Winchester. It's not a far drive. It's a beautiful drive. It's worth it to just kind of explore outside of Lexington. And you talked about, you know, the arts community there and the culture. We got to pop into the Leeds Center for the Arts. And I know that's a really cool historical building. Talk a little bit about what they do there.
So that place is so cool. If anybody ever hasn't been there, you've got to check that one out. It's basically, it is a stage where they do plays and it's an old theater. There's a lot of just culture there in terms of a lot of children come there and do plays and they always have like, they do the Nutcracker there every year. And they do all sorts of like classes and workshops and they're starting to do more and more there as well. Like they're trying to really grow that space. and do more activities there. So like, I'm super excited to see what Leeds is going to come up with in the future. So I highly suggest people come check that out if they come to Winchester, because it's adorable. It's so cute.
It is. And the downtown itself is so cute. I feel like I was just taking pictures left and right.
It is.
I really loved, as we were kind of walking down the streets, you could see some small little murals that talked about posting your pictures of when you're in Winchester. And I think it was Interact Winchester. And it was just a way for people to post their pictures around town. I think I got a picture holding some dogs on a leash inside the butterfly wings. It was just really cool to see the arts popping up all around town. And I know this summer is going to be chock full of events. Let's talk a little bit about what people can do to get outside. I know you mentioned Fort Boonesboro Park. Let's talk about some of the green spaces people can enjoy.
Well, we're super lucky here in Winchester because there's a lot of green space. It's very, very farm-centric. And even closer to the downtown, we have a lot of parks. We have Lykins Park, College Park, and Legacy Grove Park, which is our newer park, and they're doing all sorts of fun things there. But honestly, down at Fort Boonesboro, there is a lot. They have boating, camping, fishing, hiking. I mean, talk about get outdoors and do green, you know, experience nature. That's a really cool area. So we have a lot of opportunities to get outdoors.
Beer Cheese Fest is coming up this summer, correct?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
June 11th, downtown, beer cheese everywhere. And there is actually a beer cheese trail. Is that correct?
Mm-hmm. That's right. There's a little passport you can get.
Let's talk a little bit more about what there is to, you know, eat and drink downtown.
We have a lot of restaurants popping up, and I'm super proud of Winchester because the restaurant industry is not easy, but we have a lot of good, like, locally owned restaurants. We have La Trattoria. We have Engine House Pizza Pub, which I love. We have Woody's. We have Waterfront. Wildcat Willie's is a good one. They're farm to table, and they have a distillery. And then Loma's is really, really pretty. It's an old button factory that they turned into a restaurant. It's so cute.
That's awesome.
So those are just some off the top of my head. We have a cupcake place. We also have a cheesecake place getting ready to open up as well.
Ooh, exciting.
So we have all sorts of fun things. We have a wine bar that's getting ready to open up.
Well, I know that people should definitely download the Winchester Tourism app because it's got a nice little, you know, plug and play. Just hit the button. It'll tell you where to eat locally, what street you're on, what to do, what to see. I'm a historical home fanatic, so I know just driving through downtown, it was so cool to just peek down different streets and just see the beautiful homes, the historical buildings that are being revitalized with businesses. It's just exciting to see.
For sure.
Great.
It
is. Thank you.
We're super pumped.
Yeah. Thank you so much for your time, Nini. I appreciate it.
No problem, Molly. Anytime.
This is Molly Thompson for Lex Today for Eastern Standard.
That wraps this week's edition. Eastern Standard is produced at the studios of Dynamics Productions. Mike Savage, executive producer, Neil Kesterson, producing engineer and audio editor, Ella Fitzgeraldine, studio dog, Spencer Shook has signed on as our intern. You can find us online at weku.org or esweku.org and on the WEKU app, NPR One, and the Google News app. Want to suggest a topic? Drop us a line at es@eku.edu. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.